call the regular and supplemental meetings to order. First thing I'd like to do is to recess the supplemental meeting. And now we'd like to have a moment of silence for the members and pensioners who are not with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we move to the minutes from February 9th. By the way, I appreciate everyone's sentiments to not being here. That we all expressed them, so thank you very much. Do we have any comments on meeting minutes? If not, can we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag?
No, there's nothing unusual.
Okay. So can we have a motion to approve that?
Move approval.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any
aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Aye, sir. From anybody on the phone.
Oh, sorry. Anyone from the public would like to speak, either it's in person. Christy? Yeah.
So I just want to introduce myself if I have not met y'all before. I'm Christy Walter. My husband is a firefighter and died in the line of duty in November 2018. And when I started speaking to y'all maybe 15 months, a year and a half ago, about the inequities in this plan, and I noticed that when the children's half of our pension was taken away when my youngest son aged out, I came to y'all and I said, please help me. And the more I dig into this pension plan, I just see that there are certain inequities. And it's not because certain people did a better job than someone else or another job. Everyone was a police officer or firefighter in this pension. It all just comes down to the way the pension laws that some people have and some people have not. And I'm just asking for that inequity to be fixed. It's going to level the ground a little bit. Remind you of that's why I originally brought this up, the importance of taking care of the members of this
plan. I would just say, Christy, that you've spoken to us a couple of times, and you know you have pushed, but you've been respectful. Really, you are the blueprint for, I think, how people who are in our community should voice strong concerns, and you've been a catalyst for us considering a lot of things, so you know, we hear you and really appreciate, you know, we know how strongly you feel about this, and we can't ever understand, you know, or completely empathize with your plight and situation, but just you have been very respectful, but at the same time, you speak your mind, and we appreciate that, really, like I said, it's really been a blueprint for how, you know, people should present issues in context of the pension. So, anyone else like to say something? Yes, sir.
I'm Jim McDade, president of the Dallas Firefighters Association. One of the things you are going to discuss today is some pension some potential legislation going through down in Austin relating to our widows' benefits. And I just want to just emphasize to you all that taking care of our widows is one of the most important things as firefighters and police officers. You know, we work relentlessly to get presumptive laws in place, et cetera, to make sure that if something ever does happen to us, that our widows are taken care of. So, I urge y'all to consider this legislation, and most importantly, to look at and fix it for everybody, not just prospectively going forward, making sure that all of our widows are taken care of. If there was something was overlooked in the past, let's fix it. Let's move forward. Let's get it fixed for everybody. So with that, thank you all for everything you do for us.
And by that, you're talking about the same issue Christy's talking about. It's not. There's nothing in addition to that that you're referring or correct. Just for clarification.
All about the line of duty death benefits.
Got it. Okay.
We're talking about line of duty death benefits, not just when an active member passes away. So when somebody is, you know, either killed in the line of duty or develop some sort of occupational illness like cancer or heart disease or something like that. That's a killer. Thank you.
Okay.
Now moving to...
Do you want to keep on the phone?
Anyone on the phone have something?
I was going to say, it's a place 5-star. I'll unmute them if they want to make a comment.
Okay. All right. Kelly, can you talk about trustee terms and draft election schedule?
Yes. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. The election procedures that the board adopted in 2017 require that we come to the board and tell you no later than October every year which trustees' terms are expiring. So that is what we're doing today. This is the notice of that. And on the discussion sheet on page 15, you'll see that both Bill and Nick's terms are expiring, as well as Armando's and Ken. So Bill and Nick, as you know, are appointed by the mayor, and we have been in communications with the mayor's chief of staff to try to get positions filled before the August 31st deadline when their terms expire. It does take some time to get those positions filled, so we are working with that. Tristan Hallman, the chief of staff, is our primary contact, and now he's leaving the city. But we'll still keep reaching out to the mayor's office to try to get those filled, hopefully before Tristan leaves in a couple of weeks. But if not, we'll keep pushing forward on that. So the board itself doesn't really have a role in those two positions, but they do have a role in the other two positions, the police and firefighter trustee positions. And what your role is there is you adopt the election procedures, which you've done, and they've worked really well since 2017, so I'm not recommending a change there. You also adopt an election schedule, which I have for you today to consider. And then once we have applicants for those positions, I would bring the applicants to the board, and you will have to determine if they're qualified to run. So to be qualified for the positions, they have to be either a current or former police officer or firefighter. And the legislation actually says former. It doesn't say retired. So technically someone could come work in the training academy and then quit, they would be eligible. I can't imagine they would win, but technically they would be eligible to run. The interesting thing, though, is even though retirees could run for this position, only the active get to vote in the election. So the active police vote for the police trustee and the active fire vote for the fire trustee. In addition to that, the determination that the board must make is whether the person meets the requirements of the statute, which are that they have demonstrated financial, accounting, business, investment, budgeting, real estate, or actuarial experience. So we'll bring those, any interested candidates, to you at the May meeting and have you make that determination and then move forward. If you find that you can't make that determination, that there's no qualified candidates, then what happens is the process to fill the non-member trustee kicks in, and the nominations committee will try to find another non-member trustee candidate. So hopefully we don't get to that point, and I wouldn't imagine that we would. Are there questions about that? And I can just highlight the important parts of the schedule.
What would you say, just for the mayoral ones, if people here have ideas or suggestions, what would you recommend, how they would voice those or communicate those?
You could send those to me, or I don't know if you want to reach out to the mayor's office, but I'm happy to reach out to the mayor's office if you have anybody that you feel like wants to serve in those roles. They're asking me all the time, do you have anybody to run? So if you let me know, I'd be happy to move that forward. On the election schedule on page 16, I'll just highlight a couple of the dates. It seems like we're starting really early, and the reason that we start early is because there is a runoff procedure if necessary. So today we're notifying you of the term expiration. April 4th, we'll send an email and a mailer to all of the members of the pension system, including surviving spouses that really can't vote, but maybe they have some candidates that they could let know, and we'll also notify the city that we're going to have an election. So we'll have application packets available from the time we send out that communication for the next month. So from April 4th to May 4th, they'll be on our website in the front desk. It's a very simple application that needs to be completed. Those will be due at 4 o'clock on May 4th, and then we'll have that board determination on May 11th. The voting packets will be mailed and emailed to the active police and fire members on the 12th and 13th of June, and then the election window, the voting window, is open from June 13th to June 28th. We tried to get it in before the 4th of July holiday and before the board meeting. So we would have the results of the election on the 30th, bring that to the board on July 13th for you to certify the results if any of the candidates have more than 50% of the election. If they don't, we'll have to go through a runoff procedure until somebody gets more than 50%. That has not been a problem for us since before 2017. It was a problem for us before that time frame. If we have to go through the non-member process, the schedule will change just to accommodate that. But we still believe in any circumstance we should have new trustees in place before their first meeting in September. Yes, Jean.
So if, well, let's just say hypothetically, if an active cannot be nominated and so forth, then you kind of default to the non-member elections. Do you have to do another, like, send out for voting as well?
So what would happen is if there's, let's say there's no police officers that want to be a trustee, mm-hmm. what we would do is then we would meet with the nominations committee immediately, right after May 4th. And we would start that process, the normal process of getting applications and then vetting those applications and then put the slate together. So there would be another communication out to all the members in case they know of somebody to bring forward to us.
Okay.
But we'd be able to squeeze that process in. Hopefully we won't get to that.
Kelly, the existing trustees have reached term limits?
There is no term limit on the police and fire positions, but Bill and Nick have reached their term limits, we think. There's some question of whether Nick has reached his term limit. That's for the city to decide.
But if you guys are thinking like a retirement blazer or something like that, we both like the Glenn Flagg.
We know better.
Are you considering that you haven't reached your term limit?
Yeah.
Or?
I have no idea.
Okay. But you're open to continuing, or?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, my hope is to, like a lot of you, we want to see this through to long-term viability. I mean, we've made huge progress, and everyone here gets a lot of credit for that. Staff first and foremost. We want to walk away thinking this thing.
No, I just wanted to see, make sure you were open.
Yeah, sure. As long as you don't hold it against me, I live in the Park Cities. Kind of got a pass so far. And also would like to recognize that Tom, who's here today, who's on the IAC, Tom Cole, we're thrilled to have you, and thanks for sitting in today.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Okay, so would someone like... Do we have any other comments, Kelly, on this?
None for me.
Okay.
I'm just a little, if I may say, the changing of the guards come September is a little bit concerning, that we have a lot of uncertainties out there, especially as it pertains to you, Nick, because I know, Bill, you're coming off hard, but there's still some questions about that. So I just would like to explore or at least discuss a little bit more legally, if we will, about what our options are.
Or you can just ask Christy to help my cause. I think she would.
I think it's really the city determination.
The city determination.
It's their appointee, so they need to read the statute and see how they apply the statute.
Okay, so if we have a motion to adopt the proposed 2023 police officer and firefighter trustee election schedule.
Move.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Kelly, let's go over the monthly contribution report.
Yes, thank you. The contribution report begins on page 19 of the PDF. And this is the first month where the floor has declined and will basically probably not be a relevant number for us unless something really drastic happens with the city. So in January, the floor declined 3.82% to make it equal to the hiring plan. And I can show you that here. If you, yeah, this is the one. On page three, I'm sorry, of the presentation, but 21 of your diligent packet, you can see the bottom two, 2023 and 2024, on that top chart. 2022, the floor was $6,043,000 a pay period, and it went down to $5,812,000 a pay period, which is a 3.82% decline. It does go up next year, 3.65%, but that still keeps it even below the 2022 level. On page 20 of your packet, let me go back to that. You can see here on the top chart, the floor is $11,624,000 a month, which is just the rounded number of the hiring plan, really. And our actual contributions this month were $12,208,000, so $584,000 more than the floor. So I would not anticipate we get more money into that column, the third over from the right, in the future. But we will keep an eye on it and keep letting you know what's going on with the contributions and the hiring. The hiring plan did estimate 50 more police officers this year than last year, and as you know, they've been below the number of police officers, so now they're just further below. So right now, just based on the number of officers, they're down, officers and firefighters, they're down 241 people.
Those are all in the police area, or is that a split?
The police is down, actually more, they are down 298. Fire is over the estimate.
So Kelly, just to remind everybody, per month we run about negative $9 million
correct
of money we send out versus cash we receive. So obviously you look to the investment portfolio to fund that. I meet every month with Brian just to kind of, you know, go over stuff. And we stumbled onto a number that I wanted to flag for everybody, that if you were to look at, you know, we always sort of look at the private markets as, you know, the one that's been sort of the huge portfolio problem that we inherit. And, you know, we can do some things, but we can't do all the things we want to, and then we're able to file with the public portfolio, but that since the legislation started in 2018, so in those 5 years, the shortfall with proceeds from monetizing private investments at a positive mark, okay, meaning that we didn't liquidate private investments at a discount to what they were marked when we showed up. And I say we, the collective we, you know, post-legislation. Mm-hmm. So we produced positive investment returns, not anywhere close to what our hurdle rate is, but we've produced, I think the number was $570 million, something like that, of cash. And that's more than 100% funded our cash outflow. And so I think that is, you know, first of all, for staff, that's a huge accomplishment. And it's just one of those things that when we look to building credibility, saying that, yes, we are only 40% funded, but look what we've done as a collective group since we've taken over. I think that's an amazing accomplishment. And I really tip my hat to Kelly, you know, Josh, Ryan, and everyone who's been involved. I mean, it's a real... And not having that, we would have, you know, felt more daunting problems than we face. So,
more immediately.
Yeah. So that was a heck of an accomplishment that really jumped out at me. And Ryan's going to talk more, I think, next meeting about private investment.
Yeah, we'll do the quarterly update.
Yeah.
We'll provide that schedule.
Yeah. And Josh is giving me the look that I'm moving off agenda a little bit, but he knows that more or less happens to some degree every meeting. So, okay. All right, Kelly, trustee education and travel.
On page 55, the list of classes are here. I don't need a motion unless somebody would like to add their name to any of these classes. Or if you've got other education that you'd like to attend, you can let Carol know and we can add that to the list for next month.
Okay, and Carol's going to keep us informed if any of us have requirements.
Okay. The next item is the employee retirement plan transition and 457 plan. So the reason that I'm bringing this to you is technically the board is the fiduciaries of the 401A plan and the staff 457 plan. So we're just talking about staff here. We're not talking about members with this item. But I wanted to give you an update since you are the fiduciaries of the plan that, as you know, with the board's approval over a year ago, we transitioned the DPFP 401A defined contribution plan over to TMRS. And that move was effective January 1st, 2022. It went really easily, I have to say. It was not that difficult on our administrative staff. TMRS was very, very helpful. I think it was seamless for our employees. The employees, so the TMRS pieces worked really well for us. The employees then had a year to move their money out of the 401A plan that was with Voya. They could roll it over or take a distribution. We could not move it into TMRS. So employees had a year to do that. And if they didn't roll it over before the end of 2022, it gets distributed to them, and then they get to pay taxes on that. Mm-hmm. So there was only four employees, about $22,000, that didn't roll their money over before the end of the year, and I think that was by design. I think they wanted the money. None of those, I said employees, but people with balances, they were all former employees. So that went well, and that should be closed out and move forward. As far as the 457 plan goes, it's a totally voluntary plan. The system doesn't put any money into it. There is 25 current participants in it. Sorry, 24 current participants in it with balances. 14 of those are current employees. 10 of them are former employees. It's with Voya also. The fees have been higher than we've wanted, so we've been shopping around looking to see if we could move it to get a better fee structure. We worked with Voya for a long time, and we couldn't get lower fee funds. But more recently, even yesterday, actually, they have sent me now a new slate of funds that have a lot of low-cost index-type options. So we intend to transition the funds, the existing funds, map them over to the Voya funds. But I wanted to let you know that since you're the fiduciaries, I didn't know if anybody wanted to review the fund lineup or anything.
How much money are you talking about that's going to be transferred?
$4 million. So we've, Ryan talked to a whole bunch of people, and nobody wants our plan. It's just too small.
And do the participants have an option for other than these index funds, or do they not?
Oh, there's a lot. There's a big
slate. Oh, there's an option. Okay.
There's a whole, I have the list here.
So the default option is the index fund.
Well, they're, each of the funds would be mapped over. It's very tiny because these are all the options. It's a lot. Probably too many because when you get too many options, sometimes that's bad. But they've got a suggested mapping, and then employees can pick. But there are a lot of low-cost options that we didn't have before.
That's the key, is the lowest cost option available within those funds. Otherwise, you're going to have the DOL and afterwards.
Yeah. So do you have any interest in bringing anything back? I mean, just I wanted to let you know we're doing this. I think it's a good option for us. Okay.
Thanks.
That's all I had on that.
Okay, Ryan.
All right. All right, we're on page 30 of Diligent. Start with the private market asset liquidation. After receiving zero distributions in January, we got $22 million back in February. Most of that came from an AEW office building that we developed and sold. Ended up with a 52% IRR on that one and 1.76 multiple. So very good result there. AEW is coming in to present to the board next month, so they'll reminder, you guys know it, but we're in drawdown mode on the safety reserve, and we'll cover that in a little bit. On the consultant search, we issued the RFP February 15th to 9 firms, and we expect to get a response to our due next week. So we'll start staff evaluation from there. On rebalancing, last time we took a rebalancing action, we put $28 million in small cap equity in mid-November. Since mid-November, we've gotten $30 million in private market proceeds. And what we plan to do with that is to redeploy half into the passive Northern Trust Acquia Index Fund and then hold half of it back within cash in the safety reserve. So,
Ryan, can I guess, I would guess that $28 million has had a pretty positive return since mid-November. Do you know that off the top of your head?
Yeah, I mean, the small cap is up 8% just year-to-date.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is Leo and his team, you know, this is their thing. But this is why you rebalance. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you're sitting there
exactly.
in the middle of November and it looks bleak and, you know, you you don't leave your wingman, you know, sort of thinking. And that's why we do things like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we've kind of taken this chart and charted
yeah.
where we've reinvested and, you know, sometimes it's tough short-term, but longer-term, it's usually a good proposition to reinvest in the market.
Do you rebalance? I mean, this is because you've got excess cash flow that you're able to do this, but is there a rebalancing period that we didn't have those cash flows?
Yeah, it's tough right now because we're underway in equity and kind of at target everywhere else. We did a little bit out of bank loans when the drawdown initially happened, and then we did the kind of rebalancing between growth and value last summer.
And I guess we automatically rebalance by having $9 million a month of distribution.
Yeah, it kind of forces us to figure out where it's coming from.
Yep.
So, but we've done this kind of half and half of private market proceeds plan, going back into equity and holding half of it back to replenish the safety reserve the last couple of times. But I'd expect to do that kind of going forward now that we're in, you know, a year plus into the drawdown.
And you reviewed this with the IAC and they
yeah,
generally
we're going to email out. Yesterday to the IAC and everyone's on board with it. So we expect to make that move next week sometime. All right, estimated year-to-date return 2.6% for overall BPFP portfolio and 4% for public markets ex cash, which is about two-thirds of the portfolio. This is looking at the equity market drawdown since the beginning of last year. Same kind of story, down a little bit from last month, but international down less than U.S. And global. EM is down about 22% from market highs, and then tech with NASDAQ down 28%. The same chart we've showed throughout last year, year-to-date drawdown is negative 5, but this was as of a couple days ago, up 5% on the S&P. And even though we have a global portfolio, we tend to look at S&P and Dow that we see every day, so I wanted to show a few charts on the global equity markets. And as a reminder, our equity benchmark is the ACWI IMI. This is looking at ACWI, but a few things that I highlighted here. This is looking at 2022 returns from international markets in local dollar terms and U.S. dollar terms. And I look at the U.K. line. They were up 7% last year, but because of the strength of the dollar, they were down 5% in U.S. dollar terms. So just good context to remember when we're looking at where we're investing. Weight in the ACWI benchmark, 60% U.S., about 11% EM. And then in the bottom right here, it shows just how much higher the weight to tech is in the U.S. markets compared to international and EM markets. This is looking at the Fed and the yield curve. The blue dotted line, which pretty much matches up with the green, is the Fed expectations of rate increases and then decreases getting back down to the terminal rate compared to the market expectations. And the difference in this chart versus when we looked at it last month and, you know, before was the market is starting to lead the Fed on the rates, where the expectation curve is actually slightly above the Fed curve now. Looking at the bridge chart, we ended the month at $1.85 billion in NAV. The monthly net outflows down $23 million from benefits, and then investment gain of $48 million. Pretty much all of that is in the public portfolio. We haven't seen a whole lot of March yet in private markets. small here, but looking at performance of the public portfolio year to date, a few things to point out.
Can I ask one question to clarify?
Yeah, go ahead.
Brian, so when 2022 private marks come out, okay, once you get all those,
yeah.
Everything else being frozen, where would they appear on this chart on page 735 would it appear?
So 2022 marks that would occur in 2023 are going to show up in the yellow bar.
Okay.
So like when we had the HUP write-up last year,
yes.
It went from a negative bar to a positive bar in 1 month because of that huge write-up.
Okay, so everyone gets it. That's not matching, time, but it's just the way that it works with private marks.
Yeah,
there's not a right answer here. Leo has a view, but it.
Yeah, what
it's
we do
a 3 month lag.
What we do is we lag everything by one quarter, so we remain consistent. So there's different ways to do it, but the most important thing is to be consistent over time in your process.
Okay.
All right. So you can kind of see here, maybe on 36, small cap is up most year to date. U.S. small cap 7.7% compared to the benchmark 7.9%. And then our best performing manager year to date is Global Alpha, the new international small cap, up 8.2 compared to the benchmark. Across the global equity line, kind of seeing what we'd like to see with about 70 to 80 basis points of outperformance over the year to date and the 3 year trailing. So I'm showing all the asset allocation details post rebalancing. So we're showing where we're currently at and then where the $15 million is going to go. And then we've already received that $30 million of cash, so we're showing $15 million coming out of the cash account back into Northern Trust Passive. One thing I want to point out here on the equity structure as we talk about Invesco next, how we currently allocate to public equity. We have 8% targets each to the four active global managers. We have a 15% target to the passive ACWI index, and then we have 4% each to the U.S. and international small cap, and then 5% to RBC, the EM equity manager. So I think once we get through the Invesco recommendation and get to the IAC in March, we're going to be looking at the structure a little bit more to figure out what we want to do there. The safety reserve net outflows are going about $9.6 million per month right now. We have $113 million in post the $15 million coming out in the safety reserve, so that's enough to get us through benefit payments for the next 12 months or end of February 2024. On the cash account, the chart on the bottom right, we have $54 million post rebalancing. That should be good through towards the end of Q2. I expect more proceeds coming back before then.
Historically, what have we, in terms of the cushion for the reserve, what kind of...
I mean, this is like the first time we have put it into a drawdown mode. We did it for 3 months during COVID, and it was bouncing right back. So this is the most prolonged period that we've been drawing down on it since we put it in place in 18. So this is about as low as we've been.
And so typically, how long is the cushion, I guess?
So like at a normal level, it would be 18 months.
Okay, 18.
So even though we're a year into it, we've been replenishing it as we go a little bit. So we've held some back. So, absent doing that, we have like 4 or 5 months left. We have a bunch of liquid assets outside of the safety reserve, but within cash and short-term bonds.
Didn't we reduce the 18 months to 9 or something?
It was 30 months when we did that.
Oh, 30 to 18. Okay.
2.5 years, and we took it down to 1.5 years when we updated the asset allocation.
But we'd like to get to a day where we have no safety reserve. I mean, it's sort of a, not business as usual.
All right. Looking at asset allocation, you can see global equities were most underweight even post rebalancing at 44% compared to target 55%. Looking at the board review calendar, we have Clarion coming in today to cover their real estate portfolio, and then Eater Vitamins or whatever you're going to do to get ready for AEW, because it'll be a complex review in April. Have them coming in, we'll kind of work through the rest of the real estate portfolio, go into the real assets portfolio, and start working through the private from there. All right, any general questions on the portfolio before we move forward? Okay. John, do you know if Russell's on?
Yes, all three of them, I think.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so we are making a recommendation today to terminate Invesco. They are one of our two global growth equity managers. We have, right now we have $126 million with them. Can you zoom in a little bit on that chart, John? Or 6.8% of the portfolio. I'm going to talk about the termination rationale, process going forward. We have Russell, the transition manager, on the line. Staff and Makita, we've been doing a review, more detailed review of Invesco over the last several months. We had them come in to the IAC in December to do a portfolio review, and they conducted a deeper dive from there. We informed the IAC a couple weeks ago of the termination recommendation and the plan going forward, and they were on board with it. We've given you guys a lot of detail on a write-up here and in confidential materials, but I'll cover at a high level, answer any questions, and go from there. So on the investment portfolio, there was a PM change in 2019 where John Delano took over as the sole PM of the strategy, and we've seen some changes to the portfolio construction since that occurred. One example is it's a concentrated portfolio with about 60 holdings, and the concentration in the top 10 holdings went from like 32% in 19 up to 53% currently. So it's a concentrated portfolio has become more top-heavy over time. They've underperformed 1, 3, and 5-year time periods compared to both the ACWI and the ACWI Growth Index. I would say it's less about past underperformance and more about our conviction that they can outperform going forward on this recommendation. There was a group of what I would call organizational concerns. The strategy was originally OFI strategy, and Invesco acquired them in 19. Since the acquisition, we've seen some turnover amongst the team and the broader global equity team, and then there's been some outflows within the strategy itself. About 26% of the AUM declines coming from outflows right now.
How much? 20?
26. So, I mean, there's been some AUM declines just because of the market, and then about a quarter of that coming from people pulling their money out of the strategy.
Is it a crisis of confidence?
They've underperformed, so I'm sure they're getting flagged in a lot of different people.
And the IAC met with them in
December,
and we got no confidence from that.
Oh, really?
And they're just a very volatile thing.
For growth?
We get more of the downside than we do the upside.
Okay.
And I don't think that's the last thing that this fund really needs.
For growth?
Or anything. I mean,
we don't need to capture
more downside than we So.
Our concentrated portfolios are really difficult to manage overall anyway. You know, times change, seasons change, and unless you've got a cohesive team to work and invest, you're going to lose momentum.
And you need a bigger core, too. I mean, we only have a small core, 15%,
I think
it is. Ooh. So, you know, if you had 50 or 60% of the core, then you could take some of that risk, but with where we are, that just doesn't make sense.
When you say core, you're referring to the passive.
The passive, yeah.
All that being said, we've invested in the strategy for 16 years since 2007. Over the long, long term, they've outperformed. Manager turnover like this is somewhat normal in portfolio management. I feel like staff and Makita have taken a measured and thoughtful approach to getting this recommendation. We didn't just pull money when there was a PM change. We watched it closely, you know, and kind of saw the performance issues come up and then brought it to the IAC and made a recommendation from there.
When this goes through as far as logistics, you get the full, or is it in steps?
As part of the proceeds?
Redemption.
So I'll talk about this. So the plan going forward, today we would notify, Invesco already knows, but we give a formal notification. They would stop trading on the account. In a couple days, early next week, all the trades would settle. Russell, who's on the line, can answer any questions on detailed questions on the transition, but Russell will take over that account, and they'll optimize it to track the ACWI growth benchmark.
When you say account, is it in an SMA?
It's in an SMA.
Okay.
So it's in SMA. We have custody of the assets. We would remove Invesco from trading on the account, transfer the assets to an account managed by Russell.
Got it.
It would be like a passive-like product. We went out and we talked to BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Northern Trust. There's not like a good ACWI IMI index fund out there. I'm kind of surprised by that. So the best option, I think it's a very good option, is to have Russell come in and manage the portfolio. They'll keep some stuff, they'll sell some securities. They expect to have about a 300 security portfolio that would track the benchmark within 50 basis points of tracking error.
In place of an ETF.
In place of ETF or a passive auction. We're going to do plan to do an active search for another growth equity manager. So what we're talking about is probably a 4 to 6 month time frame that Russell would be in place on this account. Fees would be 1 basis point a month to manage it, or 12 basis points a year to passive-like fees. We're expecting about 19 basis points of transaction costs for them to switch the portfolio over. That would be the same if they were going to sell it and buy it as passive funds. Similar cost to exit the portfolio. And then the next step would be we're going to go to IAC in March, talk about the overall equity structure and how much we have in the core and what we want those targets to be and what we're really looking for on a fit for a growth equity manager. Leo, any additional comments you have?
The investment policy statement highlights the process. So everything was really followed to the T. There's a lot of qualitative and quantitative criteria to assess and monitor managers. So we went through the checklist with the staff. I think Ryan highlighted a lot of those. So ultimately, you know, we think there's probably an opportunity to upgrade. The best thing about this manager was they have one of the lowest fees. You know, you were paying about 45 basis points for an actively managed strategy. But I think we can pay about the same, maybe slightly more, but hopefully upgrade to a higher conviction strategy. So looking up with an open mind, we've been looking at the universe of options. And, you know, over the next 4 to 6 months, we hope to be in that position to upgrade that.
How many of our managers are on performance fees at this stage?
Walter Scott and MetLife. The debt manager is only two that are performance fee based for a public manager.
Would we be looking at that as a possibility this time? Or?
I mean, I like it if we can structure it the right way.
Yeah, we always look at both, and
yeah.
Usually you can structure one where the expected cost is the same, but you have that optionality to come in
right.
Way. Sometimes you cannot, and isn't that being more expensive to have that performance based fee, in which case it makes no sense.
I mean, one of the axioms of investments is you look at the people, the performance, and the process, and those are all changes. Performance is bad, people have been changing, and the process is becoming more concentrated, so it's a real red flag that it's time to be moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mike, taking the lead internally on this, anything you wanted to add, Mike?
I mean, other than I think we looked at returns for Invesco, I mean, they've been underperform the growth benchmark significantly. They've outperformed the growth benchmark, growth equity benchmark in Q4 by about 5%. So we have low conviction in them. Might as well sell when they're out.
Yep.
Hey, somebody who's on the phone, just look at whether you're on mute or not. We're getting some noise.
Any questions for Russell on the transition plan? Ooh. I like that up here because it gives us a time to get through the search and take our time on it.
On page, I want one question. On page 49, there's a number of retained security value. What is that?
So if you zoom back out when you can.
I can answer that. This is Travis Bagley from Russell Investments. The retained value of the securities that you currently have in your portfolio that will be retained or just transferred into the interim portfolio. So there's no need to trade those. It's no cost. We're just going to keep those in the portfolio because they are needed for the optimized portfolio that Russell is going to manage. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, so about a fifth of the portfolio they can keep and they'll trade it.
Okay, great.
All right. Any other questions for the report? Thank you. All right, Leo.
Yeah, we'll spend a few moments looking at performances of the end of, thank you, as of the end. Is this the thing?
The other one is for closed session. Oh, that one's for closed session.
Okay, so now this one.
We'll touch that one.
So we also have today Colin, who joined us from our San Diego office, works closely with Aaron and me, sits right across from my office, and he has been working with staff for the last couple of years, but has never attended a meeting. So with Aaron in presence today, I invited him to jump on the opportunity, so pleased to have him with us and for you to meet him. So he's going to walk us over these reports.
The intro, Leo. I'm in person, but I've been on these calls for the past 2 years, so great to see everybody in person and get some face time. So I'm going to go ahead and walk us through our fourth quarter report. So that starts on page 55. We have an executive summary, so a couple slides here that just slice and dice the data, look at it from a different way. As I mentioned, this is the end of the fourth quarter, and so Ryan's updated a minute ago is a little bit more updated, but there's still some good insights we can glean from this. So we'll go ahead and get started here. The total fund performance return was negative 2.2% for the year, 2022. That looks exceptionally good. A lot of that has to do with private equity and the major Huff write-up, which I'm sure you all are aware of, that happened earlier this year. And later on, we'll look at some of the public markets performance for that and give a little bit of what happened. Performance versus policy index, the fund was down 2.2% versus down 12.3% for the policy index. And that outperformed peers as well. The peer median was the same as the policy index this quarter as well, for the year as well. On an asset allocation versus targets perspective, being overweight to real estate during a very volatile market environment for equities was additive, and then also being underweight to global equity helped as global equities had double-digit losses for 2022. So those two things helped out from an asset allocation perspective. In terms of active public management, for the year, 5 out of 10 public active managers outperformed benchmarks. You'll see in a second that's a much higher number over the 3 and 5 year periods. On the next page, we'll dive into that in a second. From the public markets perspective, this is going to cut out all of the private markets. The fund was down 15.2% compared to 17.4% for the 60-40 benchmark. So there was outperformance on the public markets, and that's great to see. And that number slightly underperformed versus the peers, though. Safety reserve exposure, Ryan talked about this, but at the end of the year, $128 million, that's about 7% of the fund. And all asset classes remain in compliance with policies at the end of the year.
One second.
Do you know why we underperformed on public securities versus peers?
Yeah, I was going to jump into that. Oh. It is not truly an underperformance. So the peers is inclusive of all asset classes.
Can we
mute that?
Yeah.
So the peers include all other public funds across all asset classes. So
private equity.
Exactly. So much like your fund benefited from private investments that didn't get marked too much, with the exception of one that actually really benefited you. But in general, the markdowns were much smaller than transpire in the public markets. Some of those may still happen now in the fourth quarter. We haven't seen all those marks. So when the public market is rebounding, we may be still capturing some of the write-downs from the prior quarter. So that is what it explains. I think the better comparison is to the 60-40, to a mix of stock and bonds. So overall, when you look at the public market, even over 1, 3, 5 years, on average, they've done quite well across pretty much all asset classes. The only two that haven't done well over the last 3 to 5 years have been high yield and emerging markets debt, each at about a 4% weight, so a small piece of the total that you have. And changes have been made to improve that over time. So there's been changes on the high yield composite and changes on the emerging markets debt. So we cannot change the historical data, but the expectation is that when we look at this over the next 3 to 5 years out, that number would have improved. Go ahead.
Moving ahead, the next page shows the bridge chart. So this is for the quarter. At the end of the third quarter, assets were down to $1.75 billion. The third quarter was really bad for markets. Luckily, the fourth quarter bounced back pretty well. And so despite outflows of about $30 million, the fund added $100 million in the fourth quarter, and assets are up to $1.82 billion. So good to see the change there. The next page looked at the liquidity exposure versus targets. So 60% of the fund's market value is in daily or weekly liquidity, 7% in monthly, and 33% in illiquid. This is slightly up from the end of last year due to two reasons. One, the large HUF write-up really impacted that number, and then also the denominator effect here with public markets losing value over the year and holding up. So that 33% is slightly skewed, but still getting closer to target if you look at this on a year-by-year basis.
One more thing. I think it's important to know that out of the $592 million, roughly $250 of that is just two homes. It's just the Lone Star and the Half Energy.
Yeah.
So very bifurcated. Those two positions have almost a 14% weight of the total fund.
How much?
14%, you would say. Just two homes. And each of those is one or two assets that are driving valuation in each of two funds. So it's highly concentrated, and that's why. When Nick, you brought the topic of the safe to reserve, is there because of that binary outcome. So I think once those two positions are moved from the portfolio, we can revisit at the next asset allocation exercise if there is a place or not for something like the safe to reserve.
Great. Nick?
This next page is a quarterly manager scorecard. So this just looks at your active public managers compared to their individual benchmarks. So I mentioned this earlier, but over the one-year period, it was about 50-50 in terms of outperformance. Five outperformed, five underperformed. If you look at the 3 and 5 years, that's much better. A lot of green yeses. The notable exception here would be Invesco, which has underperformed for all the periods. Obviously, we're moving to terminate that strategy, and so that's happening. But everything else looks pretty good.
What would you all consider a good batting average across all the different public funds you touch in terms of beating benchmarks, say, on the 3 and 5 year basis? I like to look at three, but what would you say is the batting average?
Yeah, in my view, if you have an average of about 60%, you're doing pretty good. But the important thing is to manage your base appropriately, right? You couldn't have one holding being 90% of your assets and the other four being 10%. So if you had equal weight or reasonable weight, then that is a good average. If you have distorted weight, then that batting average doesn't matter. What matters is the one that you have most of your assets done for fun. So in your public markets, you don't have that. You heard from Brian earlier, very methodical approach. Each core manager has an 8% weight. That may be revised in the future to a different number, but it's going to be consistent over time, and I think that is a good process.
But you would just dollar weight the holdings and get to 60%.
Sorry?
You would dollar weight where the money is to get the 60% of your dollars are outperforming.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess ultimately you want to do somewhat better than average, but it would be unrealistic because we have strategies that would perform well in one environment and not in the others. Ultimately, that plus rebalancing appropriately, I think, will get us to that 60% mark over time. And if we can compound with, you know, something better than 50 over time, you will show.
I mean, based on my experience, the 3 and 5 year numbers are really good. 6 out of 7, 5 out of 7, that consistently would add value.
Yeah, and one thing I want to look at closer when we're doing the growth equity search, benchmarking the value managers and growth managers is a little bit difficult because they're both compared to core benchmarks, so I want to revisit that and see if it's appropriate or not.
All right.
Move one slide ahead to page 59. This is another graph and chart that we look at on a quarterly basis. It's the equity regional exposure, so this looks at allocation to U.S., developed non-U.S. and emerging markets amongst the equity managers. Sort of in the middle of the page is the DPFP public equity aggregate line compared to the broad benchmark. In terms of U.S., the public equity composite is slightly underweight at 50% versus 59% for the benchmark. Slightly overweight developed non-U.S. equity at 38 versus 31 for the benchmark, and then in line on the emerging markets end pretty much with 12 versus 11. In the past several years, being overweight international has hurt, but this past year international has outperformed, and so that sort of reversal action has helped the fund there, and vice versa with the U.S. as well. So, Leo, anything you wanted to add on this page?
dollar has an impact on any foreign assets when you bring them back into dollar, into dollar terms. So at the end of September of last year, the dollar hit a high value over a multi-year period at 113 versus a basket of other currency. It plummeted to about 101 through February 1. So it's a pretty steep decline of about 10%. Now it has since bounced back at about 105. So there's always going to be the currency effect. It's going to be small piece of the returns, unless there's a huge swing. But on the emerging market debt, which is, you know, a smaller piece of your portfolio, in that one, I would expect currencies to account for half of the return series. So if that was something we monitor, you know, if you get to a point when you have a lot of, you know, more than you have today in terms of foreign denominated assets, then we can explore currency hedging. But I think at your current size, I wouldn't worry about it, and we'll live with it. And over time, I think it's going to wash out. But it's important to note is that that's going to be a driver of return at some point.
I'll go ahead and jump two slides ahead to page 61. This shows trailing returns for the fund versus the policy index. So for the quarter, the fund returned 5.8 versus 6.7 for the policy benchmark. Over the year-to-date one-year period, obviously that was highly impacted by private equity and HUF, but the fund was down 2.2 versus the 12.3 benchmark. Over the 3, 5, and 10 years, those numbers are positive and actually slowly reaching the policy benchmark. So if you look at previous reports, there was much more of a gap, and so it's nice to see that we're gaining on the policy benchmark over those longer-term periods. I'll go ahead and jump to page 63. This just shows the attribution for the trailing 1 year. The green shows the selection effect, so if the individual manager highly outperforms, that will be captured in the green bar. In the blue, if you're overweight, an outperforming asset class, that's going to show up there. Most of the attribution for the year has to do with private equity, and that's within the HUF write-up, but some other notable effects here would be global equity, being underweight global equity this year when global equity was down double digits. That helped perform, helped the fund on a relative basis. Also, the allocation to real estate, which held up much better than the equity markets. So being overweight there helped the fund on a relative basis. And then also emerging market equity, the RBC strategy added good alpha over the index there, and so you're seeing a little bit of a selection effect helping the fund on a relative basis.
What's going on with the cash item? Is it just underweight cash than we were on average?
Yeah, I think that's
right. Cash held up very well versus the return of the fund, and so on a relative basis, being underweight and asset class that performed better than the total fund, was the headwind. Yeah. It's an asset allocation.
I'll go ahead and jump a couple more pages to page 65. There's a lot of numbers on this page, but it just shows the total fund as well as the asset class trailing returns ending December 31st, 2022. The top line just shows the trailing returns for the fund, which I already went through. I'll draw attention to the total fund ex private markets. So that's all your public markets. That composite was down 14.2% for the year to date. Up 2.3% for 3 years and has annualized at 5.2% since inception. That's beating the benchmark, the 60-40 benchmark, over most of those periods. So there's been some strong alpha out of the public markets over trailing periods. Public equity and emerging market equity, slightly down on the page, have outperformed on a year-to-date basis. Global equity was down 18% compared to 18.4% for the ACWI IMI. So, again, good outperformance there from global equity. Same story with emerging market equity. That was down 14% for the year compared to the benchmark of 19.8% in 2022. So some really strong outperformance from the RBC fund. Private equity, obviously, we've talked about some eye-popping returns there, largely due to the HUF write-up earlier this year. The next section looks at your fixed income managers. This is the worst year on record for bonds, so you'll see that reflected in the investment-grade bonds return down 13.4%, largely in line with the U.S. aggregate. Short-term bonds and bank loans held up much better. Short-term bonds running down 3.5%. and bank loans were only down 0.5% for the year. So some good diversification within the fixed income bucket has helped the fund. And then at the very bottom of that section, you'll see emerging markets debt. That was down 22.8% for the year. A lot of that has to do with the Ashmore Fund, which was liquidated earlier this year. And you'll see in a few pages that the new MetLife EMD strategy has been funded and is active as of the fourth quarter. So that's a new addition to the report, and you'll see returns from that manager going forward.
So 1 second. So on substantially all of the public assets across almost any time period, you're doing fine. Again, these two exceptions, high yield and emerging markets debt. But if you look at any of the other six categories, global equity, emerging markets, cash, short-term bonds, investment grade or bank loans, and you can pick any of these measuring points, in almost all of those, the funds are doing well. So glad to see that overall on substantially all of your public market assets, they're performing quite strongly.
One more page here just looks at real estate, natural resources, and infrastructure. Again, real estate held up pretty well at 11.6% return for the year, and that was additive. You saw that on the attribution chart earlier. Natural resources was slightly down at 2.2% for the year, and infrastructure was up 12.5%. We have our private markets report in a bit that Leo's going to touch on, so we'll get into a little bit more detail on those in a second. I wasn't going to touch on the next few pages. It just shows the individual managers. I know Ryan gave a more recent update on a lot of these. So I'll just go ahead and skip down to page 72. And this just is a snapshot of asset allocation versus policy. So you'll see public equity remains underweight at 46% versus the 60% target. Fixed income and cash, a little bit closer to target, but slightly underweight as well at 21.9% versus 25% for the target. Private equity remains largely overweight at 13.1% versus a 5% target, and then real assets is also overweight at 19.1% versus a 10% target. So this just gives a good snapshot of asset allocation at the end of the year. That's all I had planned to touch on for this section. Leo, do you have anything?
Yes, skip two pages. So following up on Nick's comment at the beginning of the meeting, you know, a lot has changed. This is a five-year look back at asset allocation at the total fund level. So the blue is global equity. So you'll see over 5 years, it's basically doubled from 20 to 40, roughly speaking. And what has given is real assets, mostly real estate, going from 40 to 20. There was a small global asset allocation mandate, about four portfolios that when we came in, we recommended termination of those, and we funded a safety reserve. But fixed income has been more or less at the same magnitude that we had 5 years ago, and private equity has gone up and down, but more or less still remains at that, you know, 10 to 15% mark. So lots of improvement, and there's still work to do on two major illiquid assets, and then at that point in time, I think we'll get to that 15% target. We'll have a couple of legacy positions. Some are performing well. We'll discuss in a moment examples of industry venture partners. That one is doing quite fine, but the others are relatively a couple of smaller positions in funds that, you know, we expect to mature here over the next 12 to 36 months. We move into the next section?
Yeah, do you want to do that? Or
This is the private markets report, which is pretty brief. I can touch very quickly.
Go ahead, do that.
Yeah, you can see. So I'll just speak to a very sample of pages. So this is one. We looked earlier the numbers, you know, the $592 million. Okay. So you'll see there, up until not long ago, real estate was the larger piece. So after continuous distributions over the past couple of years, real estate has gotten to about $200 million, and that continues to come down. Private equity has gone up from the 100s to the 200s now with the last revaluation of Half Energy. And then agriculture has been the most solid performer. Timber has been probably the weakest performer, but also the smallest account within the private markets. Next page. So you see there the green bars as the total value produced, 3.5 times over, you know, a multiple year period with agriculture. That has been great. The next three are about even. So one time, meaning what you put in is what you get out. So don't be fooled by that. What happens there is over the last 10, 15 years, you miss on that, you know, 7% compounding that you would expect to make at least in private markets, which your liabilities are growing by. So it's not a picture of how much you lost, it's the opportunity cost of not making the money you were supposed to.
So the thing is, the caveat I always like on this chart is this is just what's left in the portfolio.
Yes.
So like
we
sold a good real estate property that falls out of the number. So it's, you know, it's a little bit misleading because we end up owning the stuff that's more trouble than that number, you know.
Right. Yeah.
What is the DPI again?
Total value dissipating capital.
Distributed versus.
No, total value includes distributed plus the current value that is left over.
It
includes both. So go to the next page, and we'll look at that. So here, for example, you'll see that the distributed amount is the column in the middle. Then you have the leftover value, and then you have the total value. So the TVPI would be picking up that total value common, and it'd be divided over the paid-in capital. So for agriculture, you'll divide that 271 over the 74. That gives you that 3.5 times. I think we can move on.
That's it.
Yeah. So this is the active funds that you still have, but really you shouldn't expect to make any new commitments. These are all pretty mature. The last one was at Industry Venture Partners, which is doing quite well, you know, about a 3 to 3.5 times return on your money. Venture has been one of the best spots to be up until the last year, so it's been the one that has been received this higher markdown, so I think it'll be interesting to see how this fund does at the next reporting, so we'll see that. But it's still a pretty small, allocation, so, you know, you'll see there $5 million investment, but if you go up, you'll see 50, and there's been funds you put 100, so when you revisit strategies for private markets, you want to make sure you have a piece in the study and have a budget for you, and then divide by the number of funds, and stick to that same number across funds. You know, no market timing, no guessing which fund is going to be better than others to provide, you know, all of the same amount over time, and eventually that's going to manage risk in a better way. Because we just don't know when the time is going to be right, and which of these funds that we all think is going to perform well, which one will and which one will not. So by having an equal amount and having a consistent deployment of capital, you manage risk much better than this. Let's see. Moving over. Keep going. So what you have there is just here you just don't see the dollar value, but if you look to the right, you see venture capital. That's great. You're getting three times on your money, but only on $5 million. So this chart fails to account for the magnitude of the dollar gains. It's just the multiplier on the dollars. Go ahead.
I'd like to make a comment on this. Just, you know, because this is in my professional life, I kind of live in this world. If you look at the vintage year, go back to the page 8, you're to page 90.
Yeah.
So if you look at the vintage year, and then if you're, say, on average, it looks like it's 10, 12 years old, you know, most of these things. So when was your average dollar put in? Probably at least 10 years ago, you think. And that you look at the IRR on the far right, 1.02, and that's generous because you had that big write-up in HOP last year, so it's probably, you know, who knows. But, you know, the average private asset, high single digits, you know, you'd think over kind of the last 10 years from an index standpoint. And, you know, if you earn 7% a year, you double every 10 years. I mean, you can clearly see just right here, 500 million plus. It's probably 500, closer to 700 million of wealth that was never created because of these investment decisions that were made, and the vintage year was the year in which they were made. So you just see that you kind of inherit this legacy into what we've tried to manage. We've done a really good job of monetizing out of it, and everyone, like I said, everyone here, all the staff and Makita deserve tremendous credit for what they've accomplished, but it really speaks to just a big chunk of the problem, and all you can do is slog through it. But you can just, you know, we talk about, we look at the 40% fund ratio, and you think, you know, why is it not 60 or something like that? Why is it not 65 or 70? This one right here tells me everything. The other thing, too, that is kind of scary is when you look at firm funds that are this old, and your DPI here is .51, I think, versus the other chart, this includes debt, the other didn't. And your total value is 1.06. So that's saying that after 10-plus years, you still only receive 50 cents on the dollar that you're valuing these things at. That's not a good – usually at this point, you would be closer to being fully realized in these things. So that is, in addition, another negative that we've inherited that we have to deal with.
You made some very good points. To me, the most telling would be on that commitment. Again, I focus on that, and there's two issues. Is a similar amount across strategies and repeating that over time. So funds that I've seen with issues have been those that ramp up allocations in 06, 07, 08, which were arguably then turned out to be weak times to put a lot of money about assets in any asset class at high prices. And then you had to exit those 2, 3, 4 years later, or maybe some of those went insolvent. And then because of your performance, you are not able to put money to work in 10, 11, and 12, which are not to be good years. So that's why you want to have that consistency, plan it out over multiple year periods, and stick to it. Yeah. All right. I think this is the most important. The real estate, agriculture, not many changes there, so I think we can save some time and move to the next section unless you have any questions. Private equity was the most telling just because of the issue with HAF earlier in the year.
Is there any updates on the two big private equity investments we have, distributions or anything like that?
The HAF's still in the process and no great updates there. We're having our monthly call with Lowestar and hopeful on a few assets there.
Okay.
I think maybe we'll give a broader update. You know, hopefully we'll have some good news on Lowestar into the summer, but once we get a little bit closer, we should probably spend a little bit more time on that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right.
So I forgot that I can't be a fire manager without your approval, so we got to go back to Invesco and do a recommendation there.
A motion.
Board motion. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. That's on me. That's my responsibility to drive the.
I move approval of your recommendation.
Okay. Let me say the motion. The motion is to terminate Invesco, hire Russell Investments as a transition manager and temporary manager of the transitioned Invesco portfolio.
I make the recommendation.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to swap around real estate and the legislative update. So we're going to do the legislative update first, and a couple people who are up the hall are going to come back in.
Brian, are you letting him know? Let me know, please.
Yes. We're going to do legislative update now. We're very honored to have Chairman Connell Atkins from the Dallas City Council. He's chairman of the Legislative Committee. And I think he'd like to speak to us about the items that we discussed earlier that has to do with the widows, the adjustments to the legislation.
Okay. First, thank you for listening to me. The item come up. It just got on my plate yesterday, so I have my due diligence about the bill. Since you are the board and you're the one who's going to make a decision and surpass the trustee on the board, I made a decision thinking through the box. Number one, what my understanding is that this was the bill that I spoke to one of the representatives in Austin said on her table was that her knowledge of the bill that y'all were looking at today was that a spouse will get 50% of the death benefit, and the child who up to 19 years of age get 50% benefit, and once that child go away, she lose that 50% benefit, and the spouse would get that. Example is the spouse getting $1,800 a month, and the children still on her wing get $3,600 a month. But when that child turns 19, she's going to get $1,800 a month, and there is a liability on the pension to pay that benefit. So I did talk to Kelly last night and Josh, and I asked her, have the actuary look into this, what is the cost going to be? I got some numbers, and I told Asher, I don't see the numbers on the number guy. I got to look at the numbers, see what is percussion there. I know that in 2024, I still got to go back and negotiate the pension liability, which is the biggest of dollars back there, and that's not up. But we did talk to my lawyers down there. But the key is a deadline. You know, to me, y'all look at the deadline that it got to be filed. About what time tomorrow, Josh?
Well, the bill actually has been, our bill has been filed. It was filed yesterday. So
you did file a bill yesterday?
Yes, Representative Johnson did file a bill.
Do you have a number?
4034.
Okay, 4034. Okay. And I have not seen that number, the bill number. I have read the bill. So, like I say, it's brand new to me, and so I want to be transparent. It's brand new to me, and I haven't seen the number. I did talk to Julie yesterday that she said she probably carried the bill on there, but I hear today that talking about going forward, if an officer passed away and a fireman passed away, if that's benefit will go forward, and then we're talking about retroactions going backwards. So I got to look at did the officer actually already go back and see what that number is going to be. So I don't have those numbers in front of me. I know that if you do if you do file something, that we all can add, all we can take away. It's just the bill number. So I want to say to you that there is a liability involved there, you know, going forward. There is a liability going backwards. You are the trustee, and you are the one who had to make that decision. There is someone there said they're going to file a bill. So we do have a bill number. There is a bill going to be filed. So you're asking for my blessing on the bill. I'm going to say, hey, you the trustee. You got a fiduciary responsibility to do what is best for there. But if the bill is filed, then we will do everything in our power just, you know, to do what we need to do.
So can we just frame it so we are all on the same page? Okay. So maybe Kelly or Josh, one of you could just sort of restate the issue, very summary. What was filed, knowing that we can amend what was filed, but we need to do it very, very quickly, and what financial figures we have related to what was filed and what we might consider amending it to, and just make sure all of us are looking at the same issue, same way, same data set, and then we can kind of discuss it and try to form a consensus. Okay. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
So, I know you all don't do this every day, and sometimes we talk in language that sounds the same. So just briefly, I want to just put some definitional words out there so we're all talking about the same thing because it gets confusing. So we're talking about only people that die while they're in active service. And active service means you're still getting a paycheck from the city of Dallas, so you're not retired. Doesn't matter if you're in drop or not. So it's only those people that die in active service.
Is it on line of duty deaths, or is it?
That's my next one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have about six of these. It's
only
one forever. So then we're taking those active members, and then anybody that dies on the line of duty, we also sometimes call that on duty death. So those are the same thing: on duty, line of duty. That means you died as a result of doing your job, whether you were, you know, whatever happened, but you were performing your duty as a firefighter or a police officer, and that caused your death. That's line of duty death or on duty.
Who makes that designation, or how does that?
So there's two ways that can happen. Is if it's clear, which oftentimes it is,
yeah.
And those you read those in the paper, the board when we approve them, we know it's non-duty death and we don't need anything else. There's other ones that are not so clear, whether it's a medical issue, and then we actually have ERS make those decisions for us, and they do that for the state.
Okay.
So we do that. So line of duty related to your job, inactive service. Off-duty death will be people that die while they're still working, but it's for something else. Think of a fishing accident. It has nothing to do with their job. We're not talking about those people with this bill. The way the bill is currently written, we're talking about future deaths and their survivors. That means people that die after the bill is effective, which is next September, September of 2023. So all of the deaths and survivors that happened before that date would not be covered as the bill is written. And again, that can be changed. One way to change this, and the only numbers that we have, are if we go back and include all of the survivors that we're currently paying and bring them up to the full benefit. But that is, I'm going to call that prior deaths on survivors. So we are taking anybody that's currently getting an on-duty death survivor payment and increasing theirs going forward for future payments. We're not making up for those going back with the way the bill is written. Are you all with me so far? Okay. Sorry, I know this is a little...
Okay, so just to clarify that, you're saying the way it's written that we, in terms of defining the population pool as written, does it look back, yes or no?
No.
Okay, so it doesn't look back, okay?
But it increases going forward.
Right.
But it increases going forward.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to look at potentially looking back and defining the pool, but not paying retroactive benefits.
Exactly.
Okay, all right.
So the cost, we do have those numbers, and I haven't given the report to Danelle. I think we talked about it on the phone, but if you do the bill as written, only for future deaths that happen after this coming September, the cost is roughly $2 million, $2.1 million. If you then decide you want to add the people that are currently getting benefits, the cost is also another roughly $2 billion. So roughly
million.
So roughly it's $3.9 million, but let's just call it $4 million if you want to include all of the survivors that we know about. There's some survivors we don't know about. That's a whole other issue, but it's not going to change that number. Is that clear? So what we're talking about
that 3.9 only means to get the collective designated demographic to where it should be, not retroactively paying anything.
Correct.
Okay.
So, Mr. Atkins, did I answer your question? So it's $2 million for future survivors. And this actually, and then roughly $4 million.
Yeah, and I was trying to make sure that did the actuary look at it, you know, as a chairman of the pool, how did he define that number?
He did look at it. He looked at our pool. He looked at all of the deaths. And what he actually did is the actuary looked at all of the active deaths on duty and off duty and determined roughly 30% of the active deaths are on-duty deaths, line-of-duty deaths. So we take 30% of this number.
30%.
Our bill also, just if I could say, I should have said this. The bill as written also includes a variety of situations. So if there's a spouse and no children, the spouse will get 100%. If there's children and no spouse, the children would get 100%. If there's spouse and children, the combined get 100%. In no instance does anybody get more than 100%. But we also take care of the children.
Okay, and then just to define that when we say cost, that's really not technically correct. The liability expressed in today's terms goes up by either $2 or $4 million. The actual cost might be different because of the time value of money, et cetera, et cetera. So it's saying that the liability in whatever period this legislation went in effect, all things being equal, if we had a $4 billion liability, irrespective of what our asset value is, it would go up to $4 billion and $4
million.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
Right, yeah, that's a very good point. It's not a $2 million annual cost or anything like that. It's increasing our total liability, which, because we have an unfunded portion, it's increasing that. So the total liability, which is over $5 billion now, would go up by either $2 million or $4 million. overall it's not material. But you
David,
also
you gave us this chart here. Can you just who would get the increased benefit? Is it just
I just want to go back to one thing she said before. You said if there were no children, then it was a wife, and then if there was just children, it would be the children, and then both. What about in the instance where you have both, but the children age out, then what happens?
So when the children age out, then the surviving spouse would increase to 100%.
And that's, okay.
Right. And sometimes the surviving spouse and the children, sometimes the surviving spouse is not the parent of the children, surviving children. They're not in the same household. But it doesn't matter. They still would increase.
If it's children only, do they stop when they hit a certain age?
Yes, 19. So this chart, you asked me at the last board meeting for statistics and data, and I made this chart for the people on the phone. You were emailed it. I'm not going to pull it up on the screen because it wouldn't be legible. But there's basically three pools of time here. So, and I broke it out because they're different situations. So what I have is before the board adopted the resolution that they adopted in 2007, while the resolution was in place from December of 07 to April of 18.
The resolution, just define, the resolution was what?
So the resolution, which I included in your materials, the board in December of 2007 adopted a resolution allowing all members that die in active service, line of duty and off duty, to elect the 100% JNF. It's a reduced 100%, so it's not, you'll see some of these are 95% or whatever, but it's an actually a reduced number. But they allow them to elect that after the person passed away for any death in active service. And then in 2018, we determined that this wasn't allowed in the statute, so it was repealed, which is why we have the three groups there. So this chart, and I'm not going to, I'll go over it as much as you want, but hopefully not bore you to death. So just big numbers. Since 1892, there's been 130 line-of-duty deaths for police officers and firefighters in Dallas. Prior to the resolution, there was exactly 100. So that's from 1892 to 2007. Since the resolution has been in place, which is the kind of the green section, I can identify 24 existing surviving spouses that we're paying. And the reason I phrase it that way is if the member passed away before 2003 when we did a software conversion and that survivor has changed their name, I may have missed them. So if this goes through, we, of course, will identify the whole population. But right now I have 24 people. For the period of time from end of 07 to April 13th in 18, there has been 18 line-of-duty deaths, and from April 13th of 2018 to present, there has been another 12. So this is intended to kind of show you the various situations that people are in. So the first top shows I have 19 people, so number one person to number 19, and these aren't in order of death. They're grouped by like situations. There's a surviving spouse. There's no eligible children. These are all much older.
Can I just ask one question, though?
Yes.
When we change the resolution in April of 2018, mm-hmm. did we reduce the benefits for the one? Okay.
No, we did not.
Okay.
And there's if you look in the middle section, that's under the resolution, item number one there, and there's another one on here, where it says, will the spouse's percentage increase when the last child ages out? I don't know why that's a yes, but basically that number one person will increase. So we're honoring the resolution if they pass away under the resolution.
So is it too simple to say that we're really looking at the green and then the yellow because the blue already have?
No, because the blue, we would increase those people that are line 6 through 14 that are under 100% and bring them up to 100%. So that's
one. Would you be increasing one through?
Yeah, one through. That's what I'm saying. One through?
Oh, yes. Right. Yes, actually, you're right. Increase everybody on that list down to 14.
Okay.
But 6 to 14 just almost marginally versus the first six, I mean the first
right.
five.
Right.
And then on the yellow, we would be increasing everybody to 100.
Correct.
1 to 8.
Yes.
And some of these, like our oldest survivor that I've identified has been that person's husband died in the line of duty in 1958. So she probably would be thankful, but thinks maybe that's a little late.
So when you know, we took this group, and say we, the collective we, came in late 2017, you know, we had to vote on a couple things that, you know, could be perceived as sort of either clarifications or takeaways or whatnot, because we had legislation and we were bound to adhere to that body of law, and I think this was an example of that. And here we have, but the sentiments of the group that put this in place, I think we all are very empathetic to that. So here we have an opportunity to do it in a proper way that is, you know, within the scope of legislation, that, you know, 4 million on, you know, our total liability right now is
over 5 billion.
$5 billion. It's less than 10 basis points of change, you know, in the liability. So
Nick, just as a review,
yeah.
Because I was there at the time, this actually was a very divisive vote on the board. I mean, obviously, with the police and fire not voting for it, and then the city voted for it. So let me just go back on that. I will say, even at the time when I voted against, I did not really understand the liability that deaths that were not on the line of duty would have impacted, because that's kind of what we're really talking about. The differential, they all got lumped in together, right? Line of duty and people who are still getting this benefit that were not on line of duty. And that was kind of really the mix. It wasn't bifurcated. It was all mixed together. What we're really trying to make right is the distinction between deaths that happened outside the line of duty and then deaths that did right now. At that time, we did not, but now we're doing that, just for clarification.
Okay. So yes. Do we have general support or consensus around this at the $4 million-ish adjustment to the long-term liability to go back and support this modification to what's already been filed? So I throw that out as a straw man to say, is there a consensus around that view, or does anyone have a contrary view that they'd like to express?
I think we should do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's relatively immaterial, and people would have given their lives a duty to the city. I think it's something we should go ahead and try to do.
Okay. Chairman Atkins, do you have, hearing what we're saying, do you have any thoughts or things you'd want to express?
Well, you know, I've been in your position before, and I feel like that as a trustee, and when you're a trustee of a piece of money, that you should do what is right, fiduciary responsibility. Number one, I did ask for the actuary. I'm getting the number, ask the resolution. I was on the trustee back there. And when someone died in the land of duties, that's a different situation versus, you know, going on record after just putting another in. That only thing I would be cautious of is trying to make sure that I got a good, clear understanding that when I go back to 2024, when we look at this liability, you know, of the pension, you know, tagging that on, you know, why are we doing it now, why we can't wait to 2024, but it's a deadline. You know, we need to do something, and right now, I have not read the complete bill, but we can add on to the bill of whatever's going to be done, and that's why I decided to come here and listen to you and put yourself in a position you got highly presented to you to the understanding of the people who put their life down for us to save for public safety. So it would mean, you know, if you're the trustee, you make the decision, and my job is going down to Austin and trying to make sure the bill is written correctly and see that I get the state and the Senate to support it. But it's your decision.
We need a formal motion, or
probably do.
I think we need a formal motion.
I'd move that we amend it to be.
Yeah, Josh, why don't you verbalize a motion right now,
okay.
And we
approve amending the pending legislation to provide benefits to provide enhanced benefits for all surviving spouses of members who died in the line of duty.
Not just surviving spouses and children.
I'm sorry, thank you. Surviving spouses and children of all members who've died in the line of duty.
Prospectively. Benefits, the payment would be prospective, right?
The payment...
We wouldn't go back and retroactively...
We wouldn't retroactively pay, but we will go back retroactively and enhance the benefits.
Yes.
The pool we define,
yes.
Looking back retroactively, the benefit would only be prospective.
Correct.
Yeah. And this is existing survivors and children because some have aged out.
Yeah.
Bill 4034, do y'all have the language in place that y'all have filed, or just said to be amended to Bill 4034?
So 4034 was filed at the board's direction, and it, right now it only covers future death. So we would have to go in and either do a substitute or an amendment to it to provide what this motion we're discussing is that the board wants to pass. And, you know, we can obviously do that pretty quickly.
Well, you amend, you know, whatever you do, it can be amended down in Austin. I'm just trying
right.
to find out what you mean that you are, we all can amend it before it gets to the floor, before it gets to vote.
Yeah, it'd have to go. We'd have to amend it before it gets to a committee hearing.
So, yes, correct.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
You have plenty of time to do that.
Yeah.
So all bills have to be filed by tomorrow, but not amendments, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and the key is, the reason why it got to be filed by tomorrow, by what time is the timeline tomorrow?
Ours is filed.
But if we're going to do it, we're not going to do a substitution, so we don't have to worry about tomorrow's timeline.
Correct.
We've got plenty of time.
Right.
For the amendment.
Make sure. Yeah, I'm trying to make sure Bill 4034, what do we read now? And what do the state representative have in hand? Then when you vote, you'll have some there. Then I got to talk to my lawyers there to make sure I got the language and make sure the language is correct.
So the process will be, if assuming the board passes this motion, we would then, you know, draft something up, but we would also talk to Representative Johnson, since she's the one who sponsored the bill, to make sure that she's okay with the changes to the bill, and she would probably then talk to the city of Dallas to confirm that they were okay with it as well.
That's correct.
So that would be the process.
Okay. Just for clarity, Josh, would you just restate the motion one more time so we all hear it?
Okay, let me give a shot.
Okay.
I didn't write it all down, but let's see. Approve amending the pending legislation, Bill 4034, to add existing surviving children and existing surviving spouses who died in the line of duty to the provisions of the bill.
I think that's fine. Yeah,
we'll clean it up a little bit.
All right. Would someone like to make that
I move that.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, no.
We do have another legislative item that we'd like to talk about. One of our the DPA or one of our members is running a bill and trying to find a sponsor today for that bill that would take the drop period from 10 years to 20 years.
Yeah.
Let me explain that.
Yes.
So the way that the statute works is the 2017 changes, you could go into drop once you were retirement eligible and you could stay in forever while you were working. Your pension payments would just be deposited into this account and there was no maximum. And we've had people that have been in draw since 1993. With the legislative change that happened in 2017, the bill changes to say your drop account could only grow for 10 years. You can continue to work, but after that you forfeit those payments. So now there's a proposed bill, if it gets a, someone to file it, that would increase that 10 years to 20 years. The actuarial cost of that is also $2 million. It's just a coincidence that we've got all these $2 million. I thought the cost would be much higher than that, but because of the way all the calculations work with normal costs and everything, it's a $2 million cost.
But to be clear, that is, again, in monies that come into the pension as well, correct? Because it's not, like, segregated.
All of that is taken into consideration because currently, right now, people are forfeiting about $2.7 million. But because of the way the actuarial formulas work and the fact that the population of drop is dropping, mm-hmm. I mean, there's only 233 people of the 5,000 active members that are in drop. It doesn't have a big impact over 30 years.
Could you just sort of go over again, what is the proposal?
It would allow the somebody to participate in drop for up to 20 years. So if, let's say, they have currently have 15 years in drop, since the bill passed in 2018, they basically are forfeiting those payments. They're making contributions. Their drop balance isn't growing, and they're not getting
a knee-jerk reaction, in my opinion, because the idea was that, I mean, it's the way it should have been originally, right? I mean, it's basically the savings account that's tethered to the market, not this fixed 8%. So a lot of guys that are active right now who want to contribute to the drop can't after 10 years because that's the way it was written in the initial legislature.
Right. So what happens now is after 10 years, we just stop putting money in their account, and then the fund keeps that. And if you recall, when the new board came into play, people had an option to undo or revoke their drop election, and we provided numbers to them saying, here's your drop balance now. You can undo it like you were never in drop. You owe these contributions. In those calculations, we assumed their drop would end at 10 years. So some people made a revocation decision that they may or may not have made had they, you know, the drop continued longer. There's people that have retired.
But that was beyond our, I mean, that, right. that was done to the top down. I mean, that was not a choice that we made. It was given to us by the legislature, just to be clear.
I'm just saying if the bill passes, we might have
we had no choice. To figure it out that way because it was required. We're just saying that we don't think that.
Who's proposing that it go to 20 or?
I don't know if the whole DPA is behind it. James Parnell, who is in the leadership of the Dallas Police Association, he also does their legislative work. He's the one that is pushing it right now.
But conversely, let's talk about like what are the negatives for extending that.
So for the pension system, I think there's an optics issue. Our drop is still an outlier. This would make it more of an outlier. Financially, it's a small hit. I don't think it's material enough to really consider. And I do think that members might be not pleased with the decisions that they made. But again, so for us, we'll just have to deal with that. For me, it's more of a city issue, honestly.
It's more the what?
More of a city issue. Like, what does it do to their employee base? But we shouldn't consider that.
So drop was initially put in at the, you know, what I've heard is at the request of the city, you know, to retain people, you know, because they were leaving, because the way the pension was structured, they were leaving at age 50. So the city said we're having a drain at the top. So we want to put this drop in, and it was intended to be, you know, it didn't work out that way, but it was intended to be, as all drop plans are supposed to be, actuarially neutral. It doesn't have an effect on the pension system. Not sure, after all these years of drop plans, that that's even possible, and actuaries can tell you that. But regardless, it was a city-driven, it was what I would call plan sponsor-driven, you know, change to benefit the plan sponsor. And I think in this situation, you could consider basically sitting on the sideline because, you know, what Kelly said is, you know, it's a small amount, but, you know, the city, this has a lot of effects on the city, like people, and Ken could talk about this, you know,
younger people, you know, you see this clog at the top, there's less chance for promotion. I mean, it has a big effect on city personnel issues, and it's a very tiny effect on the pension other than the outlier aspect. And so it would be very reasonable for this board to simply say, we'll follow the city's lead. If the city is, if it wants this, you know, we would not oppose it, but we don't really, you know,
we're
sort of agnostic.
I just think that there's been so much history that we kind of need to discuss it more than just this moment. With the urgency of it being filed tomorrow, right? Is that what we're discussing it?
He texted me today. He's at the Capitol still looking for someone to file it.
But,
and I do believe...
I think it's complicated. It's a little bit more complicated.
Some people think it will help their... They're having a hard time recruiting people, and they think it will help their numbers. I don't know.
I think the recruiting has nothing to do with it.
If you're going to tell a recruit that guess what, you can get in, drop at 58, stay 20 years.
I don't think it's material.
It's not that. It's the not losing the people that are currently hitting the 10 years.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to.
It seems like, I mean, right now it's not even a bill proposed. There's no reason to take a stand. And if the city wants it, maybe we can get them to contribute money to the cost of funding it.
When's the next time this can come up again?
We could talk about it next month, or you could give direction for Nick to kind of direct what we do. If we take if we sit neutral on it, don't take a position. If it comes to a hearing before the next meeting, that's my only concern.
It's got
to
be filed, right? If you didn't get a sponsor, it's not
right.
Be filed, right?
Yeah. And
if
there's a lot of people down there that he can probably get to file it.
Do you think it will be filed?
He's working really hard.
Okay. I just think that it's just too. Considering the board makeup and the newness of them, as well as kind of dredging up the whole history of this, that it requires a lot more discussion. That's all I'm saying.
Right. I mean, I do think it could get filed and never get a hearing. I think that's more likely. Never get a hearing in a pensions committee.
I think we just stay neutral right now.
Right. I mean, we wouldn't take a position until we were forced to take a position, and
exactly.
That would only be if it gets a hearing. So we could just play it by ear, and if it happens to come up before our next board meeting, talk to Nick about.
I mean, I just think that we have so much thought about this other item that this might have some unintended consequences that I think needs to just be discussed a little bit more in depth.
Yeah, you know, it's probably the scenario, which is probably pretty unlikely, is that the bill gets filed and it actually gets a committee hearing before the next board meeting, and then they were to call Kelly or Nick down to testify on the bill or, you know, to take a position. That chances of that happening are pretty low, because that would be very difficult to get him for that bill to get a committee hearing that early. So probably there's time at the, you know, for the next board meeting, if it does get filed, to discuss more. But that's the unlikely scenario that would have to sort of be dealt with. But I do think that's probably pretty low chance of happening.
Yeah, I agree with Kelly that I think it's an HR issue for the city, and so we want to take that as an input into our deliberation, just like we took as input, you know, feedback from the public and so on the other issue. And I think we all felt reasonably well-educated and informed, and it was put in context of the history, framed nicely, and we had a clear consensus. On this, to me, like I said, this strikes me as an HR issue, and depending on where you're sitting, you could have different perspectives on it. So I would advocate just sort of standing down and appreciate being advised and kind of go from there. Is everyone okay with that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
I do think, just to really kind of just at least give some minutes to what is being said, is that the reason why this is coming up is because active, they're afraid that that more senior seasoned active members may fall off because of this. Whether that's true or not, it's really hard to tell, but we will tell. We will see. But I think that's, and I think whether that's true or not,
I can tell you that some people do retire at the 10 years. A lot of people retire before they ever get to 10 years. We currently have well, as of 2 months ago when I last looked, we had 66 people that their drop has been suspended. Some of them has been suspended since January of 2018.
Exactly my point. My point is I suspect that that's going to be more of that. I know a lot of the actives that have suspended drops are not going to are not leaving because of the drops. I'm just saying on the flyer side, I can say that for as true as I know from these people's mouths.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, so we can go back and do the real estate now.
Ryan said, we were awarded this assignment back in
fall of 2015 to take over really a eclectic group of assets all in the Dallas metro area, and help you all work through some of the challenges with those assets. So we are not making new investments for you. We're working through investments that were made prior to our involvement. There were six of them, and what you see on the map is that five of those six we fully realized at this point, which was the strategy, was to kind of find the best value for those assets, sell them, allow you all to make better investments with those over time. So the second number two on that map was the Tribute. This was a golf course community master plan, single-family home development project. We sold the balance of that in fall of 2019. 3030 Bryan was a condominium development project with a handful of units left to sell that we completed in summer of 2018. A mezzanine loan on the Southside Flats apartment development project that sits in the Cedars neighborhood but is outside of the larger CCH Lamar portfolio that we'll talk about for the most of this meeting was realized in June of 17 when we sold that asset. The Beat was another condo development project where we sold the last remaining assets in 17, and then we actually sold the land that's immediately behind this office building where you see some townhome development now. That was part of our assignment too. So if you look at it, when we took over this account, the assets in total were valued at about $82 million. Since that time, we've distributed about $79 million back to you all, and we have one asset left that as of the third quarter of 22 had a value of about $31 million. So we're on course to be able to deliver a profit on this portfolio overall. Some have done better than others, and you see the breakdown there. I'll note also that we've got the third quarter values because the fourth quarter values haven't been finalized. We're in the middle of the audit process, but we'll speak about where those have trended a little bit as we go forward. So, you know, our goal really with this portfolio at the end of the day is to sell off these assets at what we think are reasonable values for you all, allow you to reinvest that money into other kinds of real estate or other investments that are more accretive. You know, we're really in a situation at this point with CCH Lamar, which we'll talk about more in the closed session, we're identifying some properties that we think make sense as longer-term ancillary properties, some of which we've accomplished, some of which we hope to continue on over the next couple of years. So I think that's the last of the open session slides, and see if there's any questions on that portion before we transition.
Okay.
Closed
session.
Okay, but why don't we do the hardship request in the open session?
We could do that. Bodie, do you guys mind if we do our last couple open session items before we go into close, and we can stay in close for everybody?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We have to let them know we're still in open.
Yeah.
So, John, we're still going to be in open for a minute.
Okay.
And
this is number 12, guys.
So
we'll hang.
this is the 11:05 that we're doing at 10:29, so we're
doing.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so this is, item number 12. John, if you could go to that item and stay on the discussion sheet and don't pull up the attachments, please. So this is a hardship. Some of you are new and have not been on the board. When DROP was annuitized, the legislation allowed for members, and now it's anybody with a change in 2023, can request a hardship situation and get money out of their DROP annuity, and then we re-annuitize it. We have a rigorous, painful process that we have to go through to verify whether people have a need and if they have any financial resources for the hardship. Because this one doesn't talk about medical, I can't talk about it in closed session. So I'm going to talk very generally, but happy to answer any questions. And if we do need to talk, well, we can't talk in closed session. I'll do what I can do. So what I've provided for you in your materials are a redacted letter from the person requesting the hardship money. And, you know, if you read the letter, you can see it's a very painful process with the amount of intrusion we have to go through in somebody's personal life, looking at all of their bills. But this person talks about why they need the hardship money and what's going on in their life. So I provided that for you. I've also provided in the PDF and at your place, because I didn't want to pull it up on the screen and you wouldn't be able to see it, a summary of the request. So I'll talk about that really quickly. I guess before I do that, the policy the board adopted for hardships are that the hardship had to exist at the time of the application, a severe hardship. The hardship can't be relieved through other means, including selling assets. The amount requested has to reasonably relate to and no greater than necessary to relieve the hardship, and it must fall under a circumstance authorized by the board. In the policy, the board authorized the following circumstances. Need to repair damage to the home, the primary residence, as a result of a natural disaster or significant event not covered by insurance. Need to make significant repairs to the primary residence for medical necessity. Need to pay for medical expenses for the annuitant or their spouse or dependent child. Need to pay for funeral expenses for a parent, child, grandchild, or spouse. Need to pay for medical expenses that's on here twice. And then there's also another category of other similar, extraordinary, or unforeseeable circumstances that arise. So the law requires that for a hardship, it has to be unforeseeable. So the fact that your children are going to grow up and go to college, the board determined tuition wouldn't be covered in that situation because you could have foreseen that that might have happened. All that being said, I needed to give you that background for those of you who haven't seen these before to then go over the numbers. Questions so far? Okay. So on this, for a little spreadsheet that I provided that I cannot find. Oh, I found it. I'm sorry. I knew it was in the stack. Okay, this particular person asked for $55,000. The reasons that they needed the money are to pay their taxes, pay off credit card bills, one they're indicating related to a dental bill, pay tuition. This tuition was actually for them, not a child or anything. Pay a delinquent payment on a car loan and 1 month payment, pay 1 month of mortgage. They totaled up roughly $39,000. So $16,000 what they asked for. They didn't say why they needed that money.
How much is their drop account there? Do we know that? Or?
I do know what their monthly annuity payment is. On a monthly basis, on the second page, their regular pension payment is $2,142, and their drop annuity is $3,566 a month. Plus, they get Social Security of $1,900, so a total income of $7,600.
So they have a good-sized
problem.
Yeah.
They must have,
yeah. So my recommendation and the way that the policy works is I can approve hardships, but I can't deny them. So whenever you see one on here, you know that either I don't have all the information at the time or I'm going to recommend denying part or all of it. On this one, I'm recommending going outside of the policy a little bit in two areas because when I look at the financial information, it really looks like this person needs the money. I'm recommending that we deny everything that this person has asked for other than paying for funeral costs and the medical bill that was provided, but also give them the opportunity to go back and submit any other medical or dental bills that weren't covered by insurance since the spouse died 21 months ago. Now, that's outside of the policy limit a little bit because it only says you can ask for money for things that happened within the last 6 months. The funeral was 21 months ago. I feel like we should open it up for more medical and dental bills because when I look at the second page, the person does have assets, liabilities that exceed the assets. They have two cars, two new cars. They're trying to sell one of them, but it looks like based on our estimates, they're upside down in that car. Their monthly sources of income are $7,600. There's a large American Express bill that's outstanding for $14,000. If you ignore that $14,000, which I'm assuming it needs to be paid, on a monthly basis, without the American Express, they're spending about $7,100 They have 7,600 coming in, but their estimates for food was only $250, and not a lot of miscellaneous items on here. I don't think they have enough money to ever dig out of this without this help.
Well, they have shown nothing for business income. They've got a business.
She says that if you read the letter, I did review her tax return from the prior year, and the net income she reported in the prior year was $36,000. And according to what she's told us and what her letter says, she hasn't been able to work, and there's no business income this year.
American Express is a business card.
Yeah.
It is a business card.
Business platinum.
And I don't know how long that has been, that $14,000 has been owed. And I don't know what you think about this. I feel like the 6 months in the policy might be too restrictive, because I could see a situation where somebody thinks, oh, I can afford to pay for this funeral, and then it ends up kind of snowballing, and they don't really know they're in the snowball for more than 6 months. But it is outside of your policy. So what
but you can afford two new cars, though. She can go out and buy two new cars, or he or she. Okay.
If you're just asking to go beyond the 6 months?
She wants $55,000. My recommendation would approve it is approve $13,637. And then any other medical or dental bills she can provide.
I mean, I think, Kelly, you're closest to the situation.
These are the hard, what, and again, only the disabilities are the hardest thing we do.
But when you come to us, it's only because there's something off the beaten path, which is just the time frame, right?
This one's the timing, but it's also, it's really the timing.
It's really the timing.
The
list is pretty definitive about what you can and cannot
right.
do.
Right. The use of the funeral and the medical dental are allowable reasons. It's just it's outside the time frame.
Right.
Okay. So is there a consensus around Kelly's recommendation? Okay. So given that, we have a motion to approve the recommendation of the executive director to approve $13,673, spot 31, plus any substantiated medical and dental out-of-pocket expenses not covered by insurance incurred by the requester since the date of the spouse's death, and deny other portions of the hardship request. We have a motion.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Yeah, I'm opposed.
Okay, Bill, we have one opposed, but I think we have enough. The motion carries.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Would you like me to do the executive director's report very quickly?
Sure.
Okay. Your materials are attached. We had three open records requests that we've handled. The fiduciary insurance we talked about last month, we did go down to the $20 million level, which ended up resulting in an overall savings of fiduciary insurance of $224,000 over the prior year. And lastly, I wanted to point out that John Holt has now been with DPFP for 35 years, so congratulations.
Oh,
that's all I have on
wow.
That.
Did he have 35 years ago, like the thing through the switchboard thing, like he was plugging it in?
Probably.
And, and IBM index cards that
yes.
were flipping real fast.
Atari.
Yeah.